Last with foolish song, och nu näheth wind as blast and weather strong. Ey, ey, what this dicht is long, and it will well be churong, so run on and fast.
Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Mark Amodio, professor of English at Vassar College, who is here to talk about his book, Writing the Oral Tradition, Oral Poetics and Literate Culture in Medieval England, published by the University of Notre Dame Press. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Before we talk about your book, I wonder if you might be willing to give us a quick overview of the history of the English language in 2 minutes for the medieval period.
Sure,
that's fine.
The language in the medieval period really breaks down into two distinct branches, two distinct time periods. We have the Anglo-Saxon period, which runs roughly from about 400 to 1100 AD, but we need to always keep in mind that when we're talking about literary history, dates are very fungible things. They're things that scholars use just for signposts, so it's not, when 1099 becomes 1100, everybody didn't stop switching. It's not the equivalent of the 1K crisis, I guess. And then at some point in history, after the Norman Conquest, the language goes through a rapid series of changes so that the language before the Norman Conquest we call Old English or sometimes Anglo-Saxon. Mm-hmm. The language after the Norman Conquest becomes Middle English. At what point Old English changes into Middle English, we can't pinpoint precisely. And they sound very different. And I brought some examples if you want to hear just a little bit of each type. I actually brought texts from three distinct stages there. An Anglo-Saxon text, Beowulf, which your listeners may know from the movie theaters these days. we could talk about that later. And I brought a text from the early post-conquest period, Lauman's Brut. Mm-hmm. And then I brought something that people may be familiar with, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. And I just read a few lines from each, and you can get a sense of what the sounds might have been like, what we think they were like. So I'll just read the very beginning of Beowulf.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Hwat we gardena in yer dagum, theod kuninga thrum yafrunan, hu tha athalingas el in framadan, oft shuld shaving, shathana threatum, moniga mytham, meot setla of teak, edsuda erlas, sithen erist where feeshaft funden, hathas frofra yabad, weaks under woknum, weorth mundum thok, O that him agwilch sitendra over hron hrada horen shoulder, gomban gulden, thought was god kuning. And thought was an example of Old English, the language that would have been spoken before the Norman Conquest in England. And that language doesn't really change very much. I mean, languages are always in constant flux, but the manuscript records we have of Old English text, the very first bit of vernacular poetic writing in Old English, the language is very close to what it is in Beowulf. Beowulf was probably written down sometime in the 10th century, maybe composed quite a bit earlier. But it stays, the language stays pretty stable for about 400 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. And are there different dialects of?
Yes, there are. There are four major dialects of Old English. Most of what survives in the West Saxon dialect. Mm-hmm. That was the primary dialect in England at the time. It was in the southern and western part of the country. And the reason that was the dominant language was because that was where Alfred the Great was. And what Alfred did during his lifetime, he lived in the late 9th century, is he actually embarked on a project of putting into the vernacular texts, as he says in one of his own translations, we think it's his own translation, that everybody ought to know, books mm-hmm. that everybody ought to know. So what happens is wherever the copies that the scribes were copying from came from, they tended to flatten them out in terms of the dialect by putting them into the dialect that they know, which uh-huh. is something that's not very unusual.
Yeah.
That's what scribes tend to do. You take a funny form and you make it sound more like what sounds right to you.
That's what we do with Chaucer, isn't it? A lot of translators that want to make it accessible to
right, everyone. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yes. You take something and then just put it in your dialect.
Yeah.
Well, here's this next example is from Laumann's Brut. It's a very long poem, and it's one of the first poems to appear. One of the things that happens after the Norman conquest is that we don't know if it's the audience for native vernacular poetry dries up. We don't know if the patrons who were supporting it earlier suddenly change, because when the Normans come in, they bring a whole host of changes. It's something within a decade of the Norman conquest in 1066, 80 or 85% of the high-ranking cleric and high-ranking noble positions in England are now filled by Anglo-Normans, mm-hmm. not native Anglo-Saxons.
Yeah.
William of Normandy went on a campaign of eradicating the native inhabitants of those seats after the conquest.
Yeah, very ruthlessly.
What happens, though, is that English literature kind of disappears for a while in England. And it makes perfect sense if we think about the fact that we now have a Norman aristocracy. They're speaking a different language, and they're bringing over Norman scribes. And mm-hmm. those scribes are bringing over their literary ways of doing, their genres, their ways that English spelling goes through a radical transformation. So we get things like the native word for queen is quen, C-W-E-N.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the Normans come over with that Q-U spelling for that same sound, and that's where it comes from.
Oh, that's interesting.
So then sometime in the late 12th or early 13th century, this guy Laumann writes a poem, and let me read you a little bit of that now. An priest was on Leoden, Laumann was I hoten. He was Levanath's sonne, litha him beodrichten. He wooned at Erlea, at Athelin ara churchen, upon Severna statha sel there him thukta. On fast radastona, there he bok rada. He'd come him on moda, and on his merna thonka, that he wulda of engla the athelin tellin. What he hoten werin, and wona he o comin. The engelin alanda arist octen, after than floda, they from drichten o come. That's about the first 10 lines mm-hmm. of a poem that goes on for many, about 16,000 lines.
Yeah.
And then finally, a text that will be more familiar to perhaps some of your listeners. This is Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales. Now, this is a text that dates from the late 14th century. By this time, English and the Anglo-Norman influence on English has really taken hold, and mm-hmm. there's something like 25 or 30% of Chaucer's vocabulary is French.
Mm-hmm.
You'll hear a lot of doublets. And the dialect that Chaucer writes in is the East Midlands dialect, and that's the most important dialect in the later Middle Ages, because that's where London is located.
Yeah.
London becomes, not during the Anglo-Saxon period, actually during the Anglo-Saxon period, London is under Danish rule for quite a while, until Alfred wins it back in the late 9th century. But anyway, so this is the dialect, the East Midlands dialect, that modern English, both in Britain and the U.S., descends most directly from. And I should also say, perhaps, that Laumann's dialect is from the West Midlands,
mm-hmm.
so it's out away from London, mm-hmm. which, as I said, became more important.
And Chaucer himself is sometimes credited with actually not inventing, but helping to shape modern English.
Absolutely. You mean in terms of the
vocabulary?
Right, he's putting it in written form. And then what also happens, interestingly enough, is that right after Chaucer's life, or during Chaucer's lifetime, the book trade becomes mm-hmm. possible. Chaucer occupies that wonderful space and time where the culture moves from the manuscript culture into the culture of the printed book. And we have possibilities of authors becoming professionals in a way that just didn't exist.
Yeah.
And Chaucer, so far as we know, didn't think of himself as an author in the modern sense of the term, that this was something that he, did for pay and expected to see these reproduced in many different ways. But in that lovely little poem, Adam Scriven, it's one of the earliest, that I'm aware of anyway, it's one of the earliest moments in English literature where an author is concerned with the accurate transmission of his text.
Yeah.
In oral cultures,
that kind of authenticity or accuracy isn't
never enters into it. They don't think in those terms. Yeah. But anyway, so just to continue our brief little run through the history of the language here, this is the very opening of the Canterbury Tales. And since this is all one sentence, I'll have to read mm-hmm. just the whole beginning.
Okay.
And again, pardon my scratchy voice. Juan that April with his sure sota, the draught of March hath purse at toda rota, and bothered every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor. Juan Zafra's ache with his sweat the breath, in spirit hath in every halt and heath the tenderer cropus, and the younger sonna hath in her arm his hava corsi runner, and smaller fool is mocking melodia, that sleeping all the nicht with open ear. So pricketh him natur in here courages, than longen folk to go on pilgrimages, and pomeras for to seek in stranger strandes, to fern the halwes couth in sundry landes, and specially from every shearer's ender, of Angolan to Canterbury they wender, the holy blissful martyr for to seek her, that him hath opened, Juan that they were seek us.
A beautiful beginning to a beautiful poem.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's fabulous. Yeah. It's fabulous.
And it's much closer to the English that we speak, you can tell immediately. Right. Even if the average listener couldn't follow every word, you can pick out certainly.
Right. And if anybody had a copy of the text in front of them and just forgot all of those spelling rules that were drilled into our heads in third grade, because when Chaucer is writing, there is no standardized spelling in English. It just it's not important. So the word Juan sounds funny, but if you see it spelled W-H-A-N, and you're alive to, you know, possible changes in letters and stuff. It's amazing how fixed we are. And to really work with medieval literatures, we have to do a good bit of unlearning, as you well know.
I know the poem, if you spend a little time familiarizing yourself with the Middle English, is much more fun to read in the Middle English. It's much funnier.
Yeah. Oh, it's much funnier. And in point of fact, I just this semester decided to do something I'd never done before after 20 years of teaching at Vassar, which is teach this beautiful cryptic dream vision from the late 14th century, a very different dialect from Chaucer's, in Middle English to freshmen. And the reason I do that is because translation is transformation. Anybody who's seen Midsummer Night's Dream recently or has read it will know that when in Act 3, when Bottom comes out of the break with the ass's head on, his buddy Peter Quince looks at him and says, "Bless thee, Bottom, bless thee, thou art translated." He doesn't say transformed. I mean, Bottom now has a donkey head instead of his human head. He says translation, because translation really is transformation. And you can see verbal echoes, you can see resonances in these texts. When you're looking at them in the original, that you can't. Now, translation is wonderful and necessary, because it makes otherwise inaccessible texts accessible.
So our ideas about how Old English literature was produced have evolved dramatically over the last half century or so. Until the 1920s and 1930s, scholars just assumed that a poem like Beowulf was simply composed by a single author as a single event, in the same way that we think of written text being composed. But Milman Perry and Albert Bates Lord came along, and that changed dramatically. And I wonder, can you talk about Perry and Lord's oral formulaic hypothesis and how it came to be used to explain the creation and transmission of narratives like Beowulf?
Sure. Just as we were talking a minute ago about the necessity of breaking free of certain rules that were drilled into our heads in elementary school, you're exactly right. Scholars had looked at the past. They had looked back at earlier literatures as if it were produced in exactly the same way that modern literature is produced, or the modern notion of literature is produced. And by modern, I mean back to Shakespeare. We're talking sort of expanded time here. And by that, I mean that you have an author sitting somewhere in a nice quiet room like the studio we're in right now, with no distractions, sitting there composing, writing something down, not liking it, scratching it out, doing something different with it. And they just took this model of literary composition, because it was what they knew, and it was the only thing they knew, and went and applied it back to the earlier times. Now, beginning in the 20s, Milman Perry began thinking about different possibilities, and what Perry did, and then following his untimely and very early death, he was in his mid-30s, I think, when he died, his student Albert Lord picked up the ball. Perry began thinking about the Homeric corpus, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and trying to figure out why it's shaped the way it's shaped. The language that the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Homeric epics, are written in is not a language that was ever spoken. It's a coin. It's a Homeric coin. It preserves forms that are hundreds of years old, a lot of archaic forms, and as anybody who's read through it, either in the original or in a translation that tries to capture the feel of the original, knows it's highly formulaic.
Yeah.
And some of the formulas seem quite odd to our literate sensibility. So, for example, Achilles will be sound asleep, and he'll be described as swift-footed Achilles. And, you know, scholars, well, this is this. They just didn't know what to make of it, because from our literate sensibility, that's exactly the type of thing that a good editor will come in and correct. You know, characters, there's actually a famous example where there's a character who gets killed in an early book of the Iliad and then all of a sudden is back in a later book with no explanation. And from our literate sensibilities, these things don't make much sense. Mm-hmm. But from a different perspective, they make a world of sense. Mm-hmm. And what Parry and Lord did, I think, most importantly, was they encouraged or they somehow sparked a large part of the scholarly community to think back over some of their very basic assumptions about what is literature, how is literature produced. And if you go back and read Parry's work, which is fascinating, it's really fascinating, mm-hmm. or Lord's early work, it's really fascinating too, you can see that they too are struggling with some of the very concepts they're working with. So Parry and Lord early on argued that the reason the Iliad, the Odyssey, have the shape that they have is that they were orally produced. Mm-hmm. They're part of an oral tradition. You know, Parry and Lord's theory was a brilliant reimagining of things. And they're not to be faulted for not seeing the limitations of their brilliant reimagining, because to do that initial step was, it's hard to describe the extent of the paradigm shift that was required to say, no, this is not a text written by somebody with a stylus in hand or at a typewriter, but this is somebody who's standing up there creating it on the fly, not from memory.
Something like a jazz musician?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the that's a really excellent analogy, because what a jazz musician is doing is working within a framework, not trying to recreate the same thing every time, but he's got certain limits within which he can work. But within those limits, variation is needed. It's what's alive. Yeah. It's what's there.
And it's what the audience expects.
That's what the audience expects. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's interesting because Benjamin Bagby is a performer who goes around performing Beowulf, and he's locked into the text that he performs in a way that an oral poet wouldn't be. But Ben is also a brilliant and a very well-known musician. He's the founder of Sequentia. And so but the music that accompanies his performance of Beowulf fits exactly on a musical level what we think happened on a verbal level in Anglo-Saxon England, which is that there's a range, and within that range, it's never the same.
Yeah, so he does improvise.
There is no score. Yeah. There is no score. And he actually, when Ben talks about what he does, one of the examples I've heard him use very interestingly is that there are actually now jazz musician students who sit and work with John Coltrane's improvised solos, but those solos have been transcribed and fixed in a way that they were never fixed in Coltrane's mind.
Yeah.
They were captured by the recording process, but if Coltrane were to go back and try to work out that same solo, it would be wildly different.
Yeah.
So we've got this very odd,
interesting mix, which is what your book is about, the way script and performance interact.
Right, exactly. I was raised intellectually by an oral formulaist, Alan Renoir, who was my undergraduate teacher and then my dissertation director and still my good friend, and Albert Lord was his dissertation. So I'm sort of a second generation Lordy, I guess. So I learned this theory as a graduate student, but then as I finished up my work and began thinking about what projects, you know, I'm very interested in the theory, but seeing the limits. One of Lord's very famous and very influential statements is that the worlds of orality and literacy were mutually exclusive. And again, I spoke earlier how Lord and Parry were a bit limited in conceiving things, and they could see the two different worlds, but they really weren't quite sure on how to get them together. Lord actually has a brilliant little article, a brilliant big article actually, called The Merging of Two Worlds, in which late in his life he started moving towards the territory that I try to explore more fully in the book.
I know in Anglo-Saxon studies there was, for a long time, a kind of paralysis in that the oral formulaic people had their view, the literacy people had their view, and there was no meeting of minds.
Right.
But that seems to be breaking up now.
Yes, very, very much so. And again, just to sketch briefly the history of that, Albert Lord finished his dissertation in 1949, and it appeared in 1961 as something called The Singer of Tales. And it's still in print, which is pretty astonishing. It's in a second edition now. Just astonishing for any work of criticism to have that long a shelf life. And one of the things about the school of oral theory, oral formulaic theory was what started the field. The field has now evolved into something that I call oral studies or oral theory. Oral theory pulls in from all different disciplines. So you can have anthropologists, you can have people doing all sorts of different exciting things in all different literatures, all different languages. It's truly, it was one of the first, and it's truly one of the most interdisciplinary studies. And the fact that it's still going strong, is it testifies, I think, to its sustainability. Because theoretical schools have a fairly short shelf life these days. But anyway, one of Lord's teachers was Francis Peabody McGoohan. And in a very famous article from the early 50s, McGoohan brought Lord's insights firmly into the world of medieval English studies in an article that's entitled Bede's Story of the Poet Cædmon, The Case History of an Anglo-Saxon Oral Singer. So there's a story in Bede's Ecclesiastical History of this illiterate cowherd who suddenly, in a dream one night, is granted the power of vernacular song. And what got McGoohan very excited was that, and very many other people very excited, was that the details of Bede's story aligned very nicely with the theory that Lord and Parry had been developing about how this stuff is acquired, the fact that Cædmon was illiterate, the type of song he produced. And he brought that out, and there was an immediate and very sharp reaction, as happens in scholarly worlds. And people were saying, no, 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 this is written. It can't be oral. And part of it was just early on in oral studies, you know, people would go around and they would do things like count up formulas, these repeated phrases that form, that serve a nice little metrical function. And they would count it up, and then they would say things confidently. I don't have the figure exactly on the top of my head, but it's McGoohan, I think, somewhere says that, you know, if a text is 75% formulaic, then it must be oral. And scholars, you know, with good reason, I think, took exception to that. But on the other hand, the scholars who argued for literate composition were still very much stuck in that mindset that you mentioned a little while ago, that they just looked at medieval literature as produced by medieval reflections of themselves. And that's not the case. And I had, when I was in graduate school, I'd seen people get into shouting matches over, you know, whether one of the bards in Beowulf is singing on horseback and strumming or doing something different. But the field did sort of come to almost paralysis in the late 70s through the mid-80s. And then in the mid-1980s, a whole slew of books just appeared that really opened things up in important ways.
Apart from the book we're talking about, Writing the Oral Tradition, you've just published yourself a compilation of essays, New Directions in Oral Theory, that have a lot of this new view of oral studies.
And the purpose behind that collection was to take medievalists and classicists who, those were the two in North American and Western European scholarship. They were the most important groups for the development of that theory. But they had kind of drifted apart. So I got together five or six classicists, or people who work in Greek and Latin, and five or six medievalists, and put all their stuff together, hoping to create some kind, open up some kind of dialogue and to show people that, you know, one, that the field is still going very strong. There's a lot of very interesting work being done in those essays. And two, that, you know, these groups, we're not so far apart.
Just to give an idea that we're not just talking here about imaginings of the ways literature was composed and why there was this great difference. Oral formulaic theory is more than just a theory of composition, isn't it? It's a theory of performance. It's a theory of culture.
Absolutely. Yeah, That's an excellent way to put it.
The Bard of Shope isn't just an entertainer, but serves society as a kind of historian, as well as an educator and even itinerant library.
This was one of the contributions that Eric Havelock, whose wife Christine was on the Vassar faculty for many, many years.
In the art department, I knew her well.
So, exactly. That's where he took this notion, and he used a Greek term, paideia. And paideia is, in Havelock's sense of it, a cultural encyclopedia. So the oral poets were not simply entertainers, but they were passing down significant cultural information. I mean, I'm not a sailor, so I don't know this, but I've been told that if you look at some of the sailing descriptions in the Odyssey, that there's technically that specific. It's clear that it's coming from some sort of basis of knowledge. And it's not just practical information that they pass down. They also pass down mores, pass down cultural attitudes. They pass down all sorts of significant information was encoded in these texts. That's one of the reasons why they survived for so long. And, and as a matter of fact, to go back to Parry and Lord, what made the Parry and Lord theory so exciting, and it really must have been exciting to be back there when they were coming out with this stuff, is that they went into the field. And in what was then Yugoslavia, they discovered an active oral tradition that, again, as did Bede's story of Cædmon, fit very well the theory that Parry had begun to develop back in the 1920s in his two French MA theses. And they were able to go into the field and see a living oral tradition where these men, and it was exclusively male performers, would create these long, complicated poems. Not, again, not from memory, but stand up there in performance and recreate them. And they had very cumbersome recording devices back then, yeah. But they actually were able to record them. And all of this material is available up in Harvard in a Perry Lord collection. Uh-huh. And a lot of it is actually now being made available digitally.
Oh, is it on the web? Or
yeah, John Miles Foley, who, along with Perry and Lord, is the third most important oral theorist ever to have appeared. He's got a Center for Studies in Oral Tradition at the University of Missouri. And a large part of what they're doing is making available digitally all of this material. And I just get an aside plug here. John also is the publisher of the most important journal in the field of oral studies, Oral Tradition. And as of May 2006, Oral Tradition, which is still a fully refereed and very carefully refereed mm-hmm. journal, is now available to anybody with internet access.
Uh-huh.
It's free and available to anybody in the world.
It's an open source journal.
It's an open source journal. I mean, it's still refereed. Yeah, it's not Wikipedia, but it's available, and it's astonishing. So now people anywhere in the world can have access. And they scanned in all 20 years of the journal, so everything is available.
Yeah.
It's really marvelous.
Yeah, that is. One of the subjects of our program that often comes up is the widening or deepening possibility for amateur scholars at home to develop an interest in things
right.
that were once really closed off to people behind the walls of the ivory tower.
Right, right. And one of the things that John has also developed, and very exciting, is something he calls the e-edition, mm-hmm. an electronic edition, in addition to teaching and running the Center for Study of Oral Tradition, John also runs the Center for Electronic Research, e-research.
Uh-huh.
And one of the very first projects to come out of the two together was an edition of a Serbo-Croatian oral singer's mm-hmm. poem. You can click on a link. You can see the text. You can click on John's translation of the text. You can click on almost any word to get more information on that word.
Uh-huh.
You can hear a performance of the lines that you're looking at. Uh-huh. It's a rich
it's really
and
quite
wonderful.
Amazing, yeah,
it really is astonishing.
Multimedia, yeah. And there is an electronic Beowulf also that's really quite wonderful
yes,
example
Kevin Kiernan's,
of what you can do on the web.
Yeah, Kevin Kiernan's edition, which is just fabulous. I mean, digital technology is revolutionizing the way medievalists study mm-hmm. texts. In addition to the digital Beowulf, Bernard Muir at the University of Melbourne in Australia has done a digital version of the Exeter book, which mm-hmm. is one of the major collections of poetry, and also the Junius book. And it's astonishing. You can zoom in so closely that you can see letter strokes. It's not the same as having the manuscript in front of one, but, it's really, really terrific. These resources are out there, and more are coming all the time.
While we're on the subject, one question I always like to ask is how you go about doing your research or how you have gone about doing your research for the book.
A lot of my research comes right out of my teaching, and any student who might wander into a bookstore and find a cheap, used copy of this book might be surprised to see that, texts that I was thinking about or that I was working with when they were in class with me sometimes pop up. Otherwise, it's what catches one's eye. I wrote my dissertation, actually. I wrote on Lawman's Brut, and I was reading for my qualifying exams, and I came across a funny little phrase that sounded very much like Anglo-Saxon to mm-hmm. me. I was trying to think, what's going on? And by looking at that one phrase carefully through the 16,000 lines of Lawman and then expanding it, I came up with a reading of that poem that argues that it has sort of Anglo-Saxon syntax
mm-hmm.
and that not that it's a conscious reconstruction of Anglo-Saxon, but that this is just the way this poet thought, that somehow in his weird little corner of England, mm-hmm. this continues. So my scholarship proceeds from really what's in front of me and what I'm thinking about. And
have you found yourself having to go to the manuscript at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the difficulties of doing medieval studies in the States. It's also one of the great charms is that, we have to go to the British Library.
Yeah.
So I always have my British Library reader card it's right next to my passport.
Yeah.
So, and there's nothing like sitting down with a manuscript and looking back through them. Now, the digital technology makes it really a lot easier. As you probably know, the Scottish National Library has put the Auchinleck manuscript online. And this is something, again, it's open to anybody with a web connection. Oxford University is in the middle of a major project now to get manuscript facsimiles, digital images up on the web. And it's wonderful. Whatever field one is in, one tends to think that that's the field. And that everybody should be in that field. But you mentioned earlier that oral theory is really, it's not just a mechanical theory.
Yeah.
When it was first articulated, people seized on Perry and Lord's sort of mechanical understanding or mechanical application of it. But it really is a cultural theory.
Yeah.
And although when I teach my medieval courses, I use editions. I teach almost everything I can in the original language. I mean, obviously, Beowulf and the Anglo-Saxon texts, I can't. But the Middle English, I try to teach as much of it. So I teach Chaucer all the time to freshmen in Middle English.
Yeah.
But even then, what the students oftentimes don't understand is that this edited version is so different from looking at the manuscript, where there is no modern punctuation. Anglo-Saxon texts have very little punctuation, and what little there is, we have a hard time understanding. So when you see the manuscript, all of a sudden you're aware of the material culture behind this text in a way that our nice, neat, clean, left-justified, ragged right-margin poems don't. They cut that off from us.
In the Middle Ages, even people considered to be literate are literate in a much different way than we consider literacy today.
Yes.
And medieval texts are still understood mainly as props for speaking and hearing information rather than reading silently.
Right. Oh, as a matter of fact, I mean, there's a fabulous book. It's a little technical, but it's really very accessible. There are a couple of books out there, but Paul Sanger has a book called The Space Between Words, in which he does something that most moderns just take for granted. I mean, in my classes, I like to take texts that are difficult for my students in a way by, say, taking out all the spaces between words, taking out vowels and seeing what they can do with it. But in the Middle Ages, we think that, well, private reading developed fairly late because the space between words is there because it's an aid to the silent reader. Now, one of the things that Parry and Lord did is when they were talking to these oral poets is they would say, well, give us an example of a word. There's a word in Serbo-Croatian, chrech. It's actually related to the Anglo-Saxon verb chrechan, which means to narrate, to tell, to say. And they would go up and they would ask a then-Yugoslavian poet, what's a chrech? And sometimes they would get, as an example, a single word. Sometimes they would get a phrase. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they would get a whole line or several lines of verse. Because in an oral culture, there's no physicality to the word.
Yeah.
It's not bounded by empty space on either side.
Yeah.
We might define a word, and it's actually an exercise I like to do with my students is define a word. And they'll come up with, you know, a grouping of letters bounded, separated this way or that way. But in oral culture, of course, it's not visually oriented.
Visual,
right? It's orally with an AU oriented.
And because an oral poem isn't just composed for performance, but it's composed during the act of performance, what happens with the idea of the original work and with authenticity? We mentioned it a moment ago.
Right. Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. Yeah. And of course, we just don't know. So we have a poem called Beowulf that's 3,000, in printed form, 3,182 lines long. Is this the version of Beowulf? Is this a version of Beowulf? Is this what came out? I mean, we just don't know where and how it is, how this game performed. And the notion of the original and the notion of fealty to the original, they're absent from oral cultures. So one of the things Parry and Lord did was they recorded an oral poet doing a performance. They would go back 3 days later and say, "Would you do that same poem for us?"
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, they would ask this oral poet, "Was that the same poem?" And invariably, they got the same answer, "Yes." And Parry and Lord would press them and say, "Word for word, word for word." And of course, then when one compares them, you know, they're very different performances. And it's not that the poet was unaware of this. It's just that notion of some kind of it's only when texts become easily machine reproducible, they become something very different. I mean, if you were to look at a manuscript page, especially early in the period, is an invitation to readers and to writers. I mean, we would never do this in a manuscript nowadays, but back then you'll have layers and layers of marginalia, different levels of commentary.
What people actually do in the library books.
Right, this is not a good thing to do in one's own books, but not in the library books. But so there's no sense of a fixed text.
Yeah.
If we think of an oral performance as something that is very ephemeral, an oral poem exists only in the airwaves when the poet is speaking, and then only in the minds of those who were present at that performance.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it's gone.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist.
And then it's interesting thinking about the pure oral culture, which is really kind of theoretical construct.
Right.
It's interesting to think about the place of the audience in this because, to some extent, audience expectations have to affect the outcome of the work. But on the other hand, the work would shape an idea of audience also.
Yes. Again, I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is that in oral cultures, the production and dissemination of literature are contemporaneous. They happen at the same time. And the audience feedback, I mean, just on the most basic level, if you're sitting there and the audience is sort of scowling or they start throwing things, you know, the poet is going to make changes on the fly.
Yeah, exactly.
They really do. I mean, and this is something that anybody does with any audience. Yeah. You know, you sit there and think, well, do I stick with this or do I move on to something else? So there's a real dynamism to the event.
Yeah.
That's lost.
Yeah, and it locates the meaning outside of the, certainly outside of any container in any book, or it
right.
locates the meaning in the situation in a way, doesn't
the,
it?
The meaning is, that's an excellent point. The meaning is both situational in the microcosmic sense of that it's mm-hmm. situational to that performance, but it's also situational in the larger context of the culture.
Yeah.
Because what medieval poets do is not strive to create something new. They strive to retell something that is well known. This is a change from our modern sensibilities where, you know, yeah. except for movies where nowadays, you know, every bad sitcom from the 60s, it seems, I'm waiting for My Mother, the Car, the movie, which I'm sure is in the works.
That's true.
But the oral poet is reaching into a world of shared understanding, a world of shared experience in certain ways, mm-hmm. a world of shared language, and bringing that moment powerfully to whatever his audience is.
Yeah. Interesting. And then in terms of the poet shaping the audience, or at least the genre shaping the audience, one thing must have changed between an oral culture and a literate culture. I mean, one difference in terms of audience is not everyone can read, even in a literate culture, whereas anyone can sit and listen to a poet recite.
Right.
So when the literate cultures come in, do they necessarily create a kind of hierarchy or gradation of listeners?
Yes. Again, that's an excellent question. And if I may just get to that in a second. Okay. You mentioned a moment ago the notion of primary orality,
mm-hmm.
and this is useful, but it's useful, as you said, as you were very careful to articulate, only as a theoretical postulate.
Yeah.
And we owe this notion, or understanding of it, to Walter Ong, who was a very important thinker in terms of developing our sense of oral culture in the broadest sense of the term. There must have been a primary oral culture at some point, but from the Middle Ages on, we don't. In the ancient world, the antique world, we probably don't have anything like a primary oral culture because, in point of fact, Anglo-Saxon England is a textual culture for most mm-hmm. of its history. And that textuality tends to be Latin, but books are there.
Yeah.
Ways of thinking about books are there. And so it is. And even then, a scholar, Brian Stock, developed this notion back in the early 80s of something that he called textual communities.
Mm-hmm.
And a textual community is a community that's formed when you have a reader reading aloud to a group of non-literates.
Mm-hmm.
They are still experiencing textual culture in a certain very important fundamental way. So, and that's one of the things I try to get out in writing the oral tradition is, or try to move us away from thinking is that, you know, these cultures, orality and literacy, as they do today in our culture, interpenetrate and intersect each other in all sorts of fascinating and interesting ways, and ways that we don't quite understand. So we know, for example, that the scribes who produced our Anglo-Saxon manuscripts were literate.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be literate because they're writing.
Yeah. It's an irony when you think of it that all the oral material that we have all comes to us through writing, isn't it?
Yeah. Right,
so,
exactly.
And to take account of.
Right, anything from the ancient world or the medieval world and I can't tell you how confidently many of these things were labeled as an oral poem.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is it's written.
We're all reading them.
So we have to do that. And that's actually one of the first maneuvers or one of the first steps I took in this study was to, you know, sort of address that issue. Say, look, you know, we need to rethink this. We need to think about it. And in the book that I'm currently working on, I had to go back and revisit a lot of the Anglo-Saxon prose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because one of the things we get in Anglo-Saxon England is these scribes producing vernacular texts,
mm-hmm.
producing Latin texts. Oftentimes the same scribe is writing in Latin and writing in Anglo-Saxon,
mm-hmm.
Old English, and even some of the authors we know, so not just scribes are copying, but some of the authors, Wolfson, for example, composed sermons in Latin and then translated them himself into Old English.
Yeah, so they're diglossic.
At least diglossic. Yeah, I mean, it's really, really wonderful. But in terms of the form of things, there was a split. We got off onto this because you asked a little bit earlier about the hierarchy of literacy and orality.
Yeah.
And we can see that hierarchy coming out in a way that we really still don't understand. And that way is this, that Latin poetry that is written by native-speaking Anglo-Saxons
mm-hmm.
in Anglo-Saxon England, but who also have Latin, oftentimes is formatted on the page like poetry. So in other words, it's got a left justified margin.
Yeah.
The ends are ragged right. There's blank space after it.
Yeah.
The same scribe who would write, in some instances, a Latin poem formatted as poetry. So mm-hmm. we could show it to somebody and say, oh, that looks like a poem, even if we don't know the words or the writing looks funny. would then go and transcribe or write down a Old English poem and would do it as if it were just a block of prose. No lineation, no concept of marking it off especially. And this continues throughout the entire period. I don't think there's any Old English, there may be one little four-line poem that looks like it may be formatted as poetry. But if it is, that's the only bit out of 30,000 lines
of poetry. Very interesting,
yeah. And again, I think it speaks to the sense that Latin comes to Anglo-Saxon England with a full textual tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere during the period, people start writing down the vernacular on the page, mm-hmm. but they don't adopt those Latin models.
Yeah.
It's a puzzle. We just don't know.
Formula.
Yeah, we don't know why. And again, I think it speaks to the hierarchy that Latin was a learned, written language.
Yeah.
Old English was what people spoke and somehow committed to the page. And a really interesting early example of this is that in Bede's historical history, one of the early manuscripts of it, I think it's the More Bede, which was written maybe 25 or 30 years after Bede's death, we think perhaps in the same monastic house that Bede lived in,
mm-hmm.
on the page of the Ecclesiastical History, Book 24, where the story of Cadmon is, on the bottom margin of that page, I think it's 107R, written out not as poetry, but as a line that goes across the bottom, sort of scribbled and then continues a little bit along a second line, is a vernacular translation of Bede's Latin text, of Cadmon's famous hymn. And it just on that one page, we can learn so much about the relationship of the vernacular to the written.
Mm-hmm.
It's marginalized, quite literally.
Yeah. One thing fascinating about your book you mentioned along the way, and other people have made the point, is that certain Anglo-Saxon formula inform medieval Latin poetry.
Right. Yes, and that's actually one of the things that I was most excited about with the New Directions
mm-hmm.
collection, is that there are a couple of essays there that do something that really hadn't been done very much before, which is this. As you just pointed out, scholars have seen the influence of Latin on the vernacular for a long time now.
Yeah, sure.
But very few scholars have turned it around and said, well, what is the vernacular doing to the Latin texts? And Jan Zilkowski and Alexandra Hennessy Olson both sort of start by looking at Latin texts, Alki in the Anglo-Saxon period and Jan in the 12th and 13th century, Latin texts that show vernacular influence. And the notion of the stream of influence flowing only from Latin to Old English, again, goes back to that notion of hierarchy.
Yeah.
People thought, well, you know, there's no way the vernacular is going to affect.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned before, this is a richly diglossic world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to get people who speak the vernacular and then write and think in Latin. Not having, there has to be. There just has to be. It's just, our minds can't compartmentalize things like that.
Give and take and borrowing,
Right, and there's lots of good evidence. More and more people are going to see it, hopefully.
Yeah, and also I expect this is a creative opportunity for poets to think about the way these two cultures relate to one another in their own time.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, one of the frustrating things is that we'll get a poet like Aldhelm, a thinker. He wrote prose, he wrote verse. He was a native Anglo-Saxon. He was born speaking this language.
Yeah.
But he doesn't talk about the poetic process. And so far as we know, he never produced any vernacular poetry, or if he did, it doesn't survive. And to go back to Bede again, that's one of the things that's so exciting about Bede, is that he actually talks about the vernacular poetic tradition in his story of Cadmon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have to be careful with how we approach the evidence that Bede has left us, but the little tidbits are very exciting.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about a group of people at a Yabir Shippa, which translates roughly to beer blast or beer. translates more literally to beer ship, sort of like fellowship. It's the same. It's the same type of construction. So, the group of fellows, the group of beer drinkers, and he talks about that. Not only did people apparently stand up and just create verses at this meeting, but that a harp was passed around. And he passes over that very briefly. But you know, it's a glimmer, and we have so little. It's one of the frustrations of working in medieval literatures is that we don't have a lot of the resources that people who work in other fields closer to the modern time have. We don't have recordings. We don't have writers writing about their craft or poets thinking about their craft. I mean, Seamus Heaney's introduction to Beowulf, where he talks about his translation theory, is brilliant. It's just wonderful to sit down there and look at this brilliantly accomplished poetic mind talking about the task of translation and then talking about Beowulf in ways that are accessible and exciting and really kind of interesting. But we don't have that from any contemporary Anglo-Saxon source.
Yeah.
One of the real deep theoretical constructs that underlies this book of mine is that moderns have a certain perspective on the past. We have a certain distance from the past, and we can separate ourselves out from that. We're good at that. We're good at creating taxonomies. We're good at dividing things. We're good at doing things. In the Middle Ages, I just don't think that that happened. So my argument, and a little of it percolates into this book here about Laumann, the thinking about Laumann had been that he was an antiquarian, that he sat down and said, I want to do something that looks and sounds old.
It just doesn't ring right. It works with Spencer, possibly.
Well, Spencer, absolutely. Sure. You know, when he's coining a verb like tucere, and all those weird spellings.
But it just isn't a medieval sensibility to think.
It's not a medieval. I think that's really well put, because in the medieval world, they just did not have that kind of separation.
No, they didn't think of themselves as any different than the Romans.
And I mean, they knew about the past. They knew the past was important. Yeah. But again, there was this no sense of, you know, I'm going to reach back there and do this. Not to my mind, anyway.
Yeah, that kind of nostalgia.
Right, that kind of nostalgia. And that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in language in general. But syntax is very important, the type of construction they use.
Yeah. So the way the story is usually told in terms of the relationship between the oral formulaic world and the literate world is it's told as a matter of evolution often, isn't it, with a kind of modern scientific understanding of the term.
Right. And that's the model that is both useful, but it's also sort of dangerous, because evolution suggests, you know, a step forward, a step away from an improvement. And what people have been talking about now for probably 10 or 15 years is more something along the line of a continuum, where we have on one pole this theoretical construct that we can call primary orality, and on the other pole we have something that's equally theoretical, which we could call complete literacy. In point of fact, nobody is completely, absolutely literate in any sense of the term, and nobody is really absolutely purely pure orality, and full literacy may be ones.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that conventional sort of scientific, you know, evolutionary view is, if you look at it from a medieval perspective, it's epic. It's, you know, you've got the struggle between the primitive forces of the past and the forces of life of the future, with literacy finally vanquishing, you know.
And finally, you know, in the Middle Ages, they were as modern to themselves as we are to ourselves. There's none of this sense. But again, it goes back to one of the points we were talking about at the very beginning of this conversation, which is that modern scholars looking back on the past impose their models. So our literacy handicaps us in certain ways. And that's one of the things that Parry and Lord really had to fight against when they developed oral theory, was the fact that people would stand up in there and say, you're kidding. 18,000 lines of verse performed by a poet recreating it? No way could that happen. Yeah. There was a very interesting case a number of years ago where there was a Harvard grad who set out to memorize the entirety of the Iliad and did almost all of it. The one part that she couldn't get was, it's in book two, it's about 800 lines. It's the famous, or as one may look at it, the infamous catalog of ships.
Yeah.
It's 800 lines of, and then sailed such and such a ship with so and so on it, and then sailed so and so and so and so. Now, to the original audience, that could have been the highlight of that poem, because, you know, they mention a distant relative or your clan. I mean, it had to have some meaning that to us we've just lost. Our literate mentality can't get us around that. Yeah. Literacy has opened things up for us in so many wonderful ways, and I'm not in any way advocating that we should. Yeah. But we have to realize that by bringing in this set of cultural assumptions, we've closed ourselves off to another set. And that's some of the most brilliant and lasting important work that Parry and Lord did, was just to make literate scholars question what they do and not apply interpretive strategies to earlier literatures that are ill-fitting at best and impertinent at worst.
Yeah. You mentioned, interestingly, that within many old English narratives, there are scenes of reading that figure prominently, which is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. They figure prominently, and they also figure problematically. and there's, well, I'll give you one very, very famous example, which may, I haven't seen the Beowulf movie yet, sadly, but it may actually be in there. Yeah. After killing Grendel, sorry if I give away a plot point there, but after killing Grendel and Grendel's mother, Beowulf goes back to, in the poem, not about the movie, goes back to Herod, and he carries back the second time the sword hilt, an Eld Sverd Eotanish, an old sword of the giants that he had used to kill Grendel's mother. The sword melts, and only thing that's left is the hilt. And in the poem, he hands this hilt over to Hrothgar, the king of the Danes, and Hrothgar then sees on the hilt the history from olden times.
And it seems to be a moment of reading.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Yeah. Is he looking at some sort of pictograph that's mm-hmm. etched on there? Is it a runic inscription? Is it something? So we don't know. And in Daniel, the poem Daniel, famously some words appear. So the Anglo-Saxons knew about reading. They knew about talking books. The trope of the talking book, I would suspect most cultures have that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very interesting. So a lot of the riddles
would
say things like, say what I mean. So it's a text in which voice has been given mm-hmm. that's necessary at some level.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of metatextually comments on its own textuality. Yeah. So,
yeah, no, the scene isn't in the movie.
You've seen it.
Yeah, I've seen the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, and most of the formula in the movie seem to be taken from either Lord of the Rings or Maxfield Parrish. Isn't some correspondence, but
But that's fine. I mean, that's what they've.
Well, there are formula in it though. You know, Grendel's very much like Gollum. Okay. Same kind of special effects.
Oh,
anyway,
okay, cool. I very much want to go see the Beowulf movie and. Yeah. I think people who go into that movie, expecting to see the poem, those people who know the poem well, expecting to see that, well, they're not going to see it because it's not something you can really perform.
Yeah.
I don't think you can anyway. So it sounds like what the screenwriters have done and what the director has done is sort of take elements and imaginatively recreate them for a contemporary audience.
Yeah.
That may have been exactly what the Beowulf mm-hmm. poet was doing with the narrative of Beowulf.
Yeah.
It might have been that at the time when that poem was recited, created, that monsters were all the rage. As a matter of fact, the manuscript that holds Beowulf has other monstrous narratives in it. So, you know, it may be sort of a monster tale that if we could find a living Anglo-Saxon who heard Beowulf perform back then in different times, we could say, oh, no, that's wrong, you know, or that's just that one guy's version of it. We don't, you know, this may be the copy of Beowulf. It may be one of, you know, who knows how many different versions that circulated.
Yeah. So how does a non-performative oral poetics work? I mean, where the poet is using oral formula but not composing in front of a live audience, which is the case you make in the book.
Right, yes. Again, that speaks very much to the heart of the book because for years I had felt that oral studies had been plagued a little bit by the necessity to always have a performer back there, to always have a voice. And so was somebody able to take our manuscript of Beowulf down from dictation? No, I don't think so, because you can't write that quickly with a quill. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible. It doesn't seem likely. So what I started thinking about then, and also started thinking about why and how we get this sort of sameness on texts produced hundreds of years apart, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really has to do with the fact that really what a non-performative poetics is, and the name itself tries to be explanatory, it's more a way of thinking poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of entering into, John Foley has this wonderful formulation called the performance arena.
Mm-hmm.
And in John's thinking, a poet sort of steps into that, and that's a specialized space that licenses a certain type of communication.
Uh-huh.
And once the poet is in that space, it also licenses a certain type of reception. So you get sort of performance and reception lining up. What I did was I adapted that idea of John's and thought about something that I call a compositional arena.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's something about Old English poetry. I mean, if we look at Old English poetry, it's remarkably homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
It looks the same. It sounds the same. There is only one meter to Old English poetry.
Mm-hmm.
There is only one metrical system. Now, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, Latin verse, the Latin verse that's being produced in England during the Anglo-Saxon period has all different sorts of metrical possibilities. But there was something, for some reason, when somebody would compose a Latin verse using any of a different sort of meter, when that same poet, say, might turn to Old English verse, he or she would use this four-beat alliterative metrical system. And thinking about that, thinking about why, made me think that, well, maybe there's just something so powerful about that way of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what Old English poetry is. And that's really what all oral poetry is. All oral poetry is a specialized way of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier that the Homeric poems are written in a language that nobody ever spoke. I should clarify that by saying on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It was not the language of actual discourse. But in point of fact, it was a very specialized way of speaking. So the poet would step in there and then have access to this whole world of ideas and expressions. Same thing with Anglo-Saxon England.
Yeah.
And what we get in Anglo-Saxon England, I think, is a tradition that is still so strong that the poet doesn't have to be in that moment of composition, a performative composition, but can be in a private moment of composition.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, there's something about it. And we see it start to break down with the introduction of the Normans and their new culture. So it's something to do, I think, with the homogeneous nature of Anglo-Saxon culture, the Anglo-Saxon language.
Yeah.
not that it resisted things, but in a way it really did.
Yeah. So can you give a few examples in medieval English literature where oral poetics are operative in literary works and how these play on audience expectations? And maybe we should start with Beowulf.
Sure, that sounds great. There are many different varieties, and oral poetics functions on many different levels. It functions on the level of a single term. It functions on the level of a phrase that gets knit together. It functions on the level of a theme, which is a recurring sort of motif. It also functions on the level of a story pattern, which is the broadest. And it's really rather interesting that story patterns can be shared between time periods and be shared culturally. Themes can also be shared to some extent. But as we move back down to the smaller units, those are the ones that become more culturally specific. So to take an example from Beowulf, there's a term in Beowulf, jabolgen. It survives in modern English as bulge. And in Old English literature, it tends to mean swollen or distended with anger. And it's a term that, when it is used in that poem, functions as a little sort of hot button, almost like a hot link, to use an image from the internet, that then opens up a whole other world of associations and a whole other world of expectations within an audience attuned to hear it. And in Beowulf, what Jabolgen does is it attunes the audience to the fact that a slaughterous encounter is going to happen. It's one of those words that when we hear it, the slaughter doesn't happen immediately, but it happens soon. It happens.
So the audience knows they're going to get a slaughter scene.
There's going to be bloodshed. Yeah, they're going to be bloodshed. It's sort of like, you know, I don't know what a good modern... I don't see slasher films, but slasher films are full of these kind of cues.
Yeah.
The babysitter at home with the telephone ringing. You know.
Yeah, the couple in the car in the,
Right,
you know.
You just know. So these, and actually... Those connections, I think, are very important connections to understanding not the articulation of the oral poetics, because that's what changes, but the survival of it and the power of it. And one of the things I do in the book is I decided in the last chapter to depart from the typical scholarly model and push forward, in a chapter I titled Continuations, push forward this notion of how these traditional features may still work. And I look in there, I look at some themes that seem to have come across over the centuries, and a story pattern, the lone hero story pattern. And you asked before, how does research progress? Sometimes it's just by dumb luck. I was watching a movie with my children, my daughter, who has not forgiven me for putting this little episode in the book, and maybe never will, but she's now a freshman at college, so she's away. But and I realized that what we were watching was very closely related to a story pattern that runs through much of Western literature, the lone hero story pattern. And what really got me excited was that it had a very similar effect on my daughter watching this movie where this guy is going to sacrifice himself so the world doesn't get blown up, as lone heroes, Beowulf facing the dragon, we think had on that.
What was the movie?
It was Clint Eastwood's Space Cowboys.
Oh, okay.
And there's a moment in that movie where this, I mean, in a cowboy movie, you expect sort of, you know, the loneliness to come up. Where this character, he's going to take a jetpack to an asteroid that's going to go into an even bigger asteroid. But he has enough power to get to the asteroid, but not to get off, to sort of redirect it. But then he's going to have to suffer. You know, he'll die, but he'll save the whole world. And it's exactly the same dynamic. And there's no direct linguistic link between the two. But again, on that larger, more amorphous pattern, it's still there.
Yeah, in terms of audience expectations.
Audience expectations.
As far as narrative goes.
Right, exactly. And I mean, one of the things I want to do, and there's a sort of a, you know, several future little side studies that are percolating around in my head as after this, is, you know, I want to go look at more films and see how they use them. Because shining objects, which in medieval thematics are very important, still are very important. You know, the cowboy who's walking down the street, will something will glint and it'll be a rifle barrel. And, you know, I mean, these are, I think, important cultural markers that are not used in exactly the same way, but at some level are still functioning. And that, to me, is something that's fascinating.
Yeah, all through medieval literature, and especially Germanic medieval literature, you get the glittering armor, you get these...
glittering objects are always problematic in the medieval West, Germanic literature in particular. So, but to go back to our specific example of Jabolgen, this term will pop up, and then what do you know? It will be satisfied.
Yeah, interesting. So it looks like we're running out of time. So I'd like to thank you, Mark, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today, especially with your laryngitis.
I do have to apologize for my croakiness. I mean, I want to thank you, Tom, for having me come in and having such a stimulating conversation.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Those were really terrific questions.
It's been a lot of fun. We've been talking with Mark Amodio, professor of English at Vassar College, who was here to discuss his book, Writing the Oral Tradition, Oral Poetics and Literate Culture in Medieval England, published by the University of Notre Dame Press. This is our last broadcast for the year. We'll be back at the end of January. Have a nice holiday. You're listening to WBKR FM Poughkeepsie.
FirstGov.gov is where to go for a wide range of government information, driver's license renewals, student loans, government auctions, even a list of the top 10 U.S. baby names. Yep, when we say wide range, we mean it. FirstGov.gov, it's government made easy.